Hi, this is Bill Thomas at Prairie Public. The One Book, One North Dakota series, sponsored by Humanities North Dakota with support from the Paris Family Foundation, brings you an author of a book. And what they do, what they've been doing right now, is having them come on in a webinar, a Zoom webinar, so that people can interact with them. And what you're about to hear is excerpts from a Zoom webinar done with author Patrice Tanaka. Very accomplished public relations executive, very successful in New York City, having moved there from Hawaii. Yet she was struggling. She felt the impact of 9/11 on her beloved Manhattan. She was caring for a husband with what turned out to be fatal brain tumor. And with the economic recession after 9/11, her PR agency was struggling, and she was having to figure out how to survive and work with her colleagues. Into this came ballroom dancing, which transformed her life. Now, that sounds pretty corny. It sounds like a cliche plot. But as she tells it, there's more to it than that. Her book is called Becoming Ginger Rogers. Here's Patrice Tanaka.
I went to see an executive coach in the aftermath of 9/11 because, like a lot of New Yorkers, I was still reeling from the shock and horror of that day. I was also exhausted from building my agency with 12 other partners. And I was also, I had been caring for a husband who had been battling a brain tumor for 16 years by that time. So I was totally exhausted. And I came to see the coach, hoping that she could help me. And the first thing she says to me is, "I can help you, but I need you to first do one thing for me." And of course, what is that? And she said, "I need you to rethink your purpose in life so I can help you live that purpose and you can feel better, you know, going forward." When I heard that, I was really annoyed because I just finished telling her I could barely get out of bed in the morning. I was so depressed. I didn't have the energy to rethink my purpose in life, but she was pretty adamant that I had to do this. So I did, over the next 2 weeks, you know, kind of considered and rejected many life purpose statements until I finally landed on one, which I shared with her at our next session 2 weeks later. And I shared, as soon as I shared this purpose with her, I just remember feeling that somehow my life took off in a way that was totally unexpected for me. I shared with her that my purpose was simply to choose joy in my life, to be mindful of that joy and to share that joy with others. I told her if I could live every day this way, I think I could live a very fulfilling life. And so she's the one who, you know, made me remember that when I was a young girl of 8 or 9, my dream was to dance like Ginger Rogers. And here I'm, you know, sitting before her, age 50, having never taken up dancing, never taken up ballroom dancing, which was my great dream since I was 8. So my homework assignment was to book myself a dance lesson. That's how I got into ballroom dancing. And I have to say that I think ballroom dancing actually saved my life, because it was the first thing that I had done in years where it was just only about me. Something that I wanted to do, something that brought me joy. Otherwise, my whole life was all about being there for others, meeting their needs and deadlines. I had no time to do anything for myself. So taking up ballroom dancing was my first step in choosing myself and choosing joy for myself.
Here is Patrice reading a section from early in the book that explains a little bit more about that fascination.
At the time we introduced the Dyson vacuum to America, I had been in public relations for 25 years. I started out in Hawaii, but had moved to New York in my early 20s. Although I grew up in Honolulu, the daughter of second-generation Japanese Americans, I never felt at home in the tropics. While other girls were giggling about cute local boys who spoke pidgin English, I was dreaming of life in Manhattan. That was where I belonged. I knew it from the age of 9. As a grade schooler, I lived in the make-believe world of black and white films of the 1930s and 40s, which played regularly on television. In that world, elegant men and women dressed to the nines, danced until dawn at glittering nightclubs, and talked on white telephones in their Art Deco penthouse apartments. I longed to be one of those tall, slim, beautiful women. It was the dancing in those movies that enthralled me more than anything else. I adored scenes like the one in Top Hat, where Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers danced to the song, cheek to cheek, he in tails and she in a white feathered gown. Fred and Ginger flowed together effortlessly, their movements a perfectly synchronized expression of their longing for one another. Ginger was light and luminous. She floated in Fred's arms, and when he gently dipped her, the gown fanned out like lush, elegant plumage. I was awestruck by their poetry in motion. In another of my favorite films, Flying Down to Rio, a flamboyant nightclub waiter tells Fred and Ginger that in Brazil, the American foxtrot is considered too tame, too dull. Our people prefer the carioca. You mean they prefer it in public? Asks a slightly scandalized Ginger. Si, senorita, everybody in Brazil. The couple proceeds to tear up the dance floor with an improvised carioca performed with foreheads touching and feet flying, a mashup of samba, foxtrot, rumba, and tap. The scene sparked in me a lifelong love of the samba. The setting of fabled Rio de Janeiro, with aerial shots of Sugarloaf Mountain and Corcovado Mountain, topped by the famous statue, Christ the Redeemer, stoked my yearning for travel. I could hardly wait until I was old enough to flee Hawaii for the bright lights of New York and beyond.
Patrice Tanaka reading from her book, Becoming Ginger Rogers. And she did get into ballroom dance, changed her life. She wrote a book about it. And I asked her how she came to write that book.
Well, when I decided that I wanted to write the book, and I wanted to write the book to be able to live the life purpose that I shared with my coach, which was to choose joy in my life, to be mindful of that joy and to share that joy with others. I realized after I'd been taking, you know, ballroom dancing for, I don't know, 3-4 years that I was getting a lot of joy, but how was I sharing that joy? Because that is part of my life purpose. Choose joy, be mindful of it, and share it with others. So then I thought, okay, I'll write a book to share what I learned, the lessons that I learned from ballroom dancing. And the way that I positioned it to the agent that I worked with and how she positioned it to publishers that she was interested in selling it into was that these were lessons from the ballroom world that had application beyond the dance floor into your personal and professional life. So the book was, you know, so that was the premise of the book. It wasn't an either or proposition. And that wasn't really interesting for me because I wanted to talk about the lessons that I learned from the ballroom world and the application of it in my personal and professional life and what the result was from the application of that. And that's why the subtitle of my book is How Ballroom Dancing Made Me a Happier Woman, a Better Partner, and a Smarter CEO, because it did all of those things. It wasn't just about what a lovely time I had dancing in this ballroom competition. I learned pretty significant lessons that really has served me well to this day.
I asked Patrice Tanaka if any hobby would have done to help her move on from her struggles, or did it have to be ballroom dancing? And she said, well, it didn't have to be ballroom dancing, but not any hobby would do.
Before I started ballroom dancing, I actually thought that I was a pretty conscious person and that I was present in mind, body, and spirit. And what I realized when I started taking ballroom dancing is that I was really only present in my mind and in my spirit, but not in my body. And when you are dancing, and if you want to dance well, you have to be fully present, mind, body, and spirit, executing your present step full out and fearlessly, because that's what produces your next step or your future. And to the degree to which you are still beating yourself up over your recent misstep, you're stuck in the past, which is directly compromising your present step, which will have a domino negative effect on your next step, which is your future. So the only safe place to be, I say in the book, is fully present, mind, body, and spirit, executing your present step full out and fearlessly. And that's important too, not just walking through the steps, but executing your present step or whatever it is that you're doing in life full out and fearlessly, because that is how you're going to produce the best result going forward. And that is how you're building your future, based on how well you execute in the present moment. So if I were taking up another activity, say running on the treadmill or doing a marathon even, or just being a runner, right? I could run and still be thinking about things not having to do with running. When you are dancing, you cannot be thinking about anything except for the step that you're executing and focusing just on that, because there's a lot, you know, of, you have choreography that you have to dance and you have to remember and you have to dance every step of it, you know, full out and fearlessly. So you cannot be thinking about what you're going to make for dinner or, you know, what happened in the office. And because of that, it's actually a total respite from the rest of your life, because you cannot be thinking about anything else outside of just dancing and executing your present step full out and fearlessly. And that's why after a dance lesson, when I went back to the office, it was like being fully refreshed, because I had a total timeout and away from the office. And I don't think it would be the same effect with some of the other activities you mentioned. Maybe some of them, but not all of them.
Dennis Cooley, who's a philosophy professor at NDSU, was listening, and he put in a question to Patrice about leading and following.
Yeah, and that was another major lesson I learned, because, you know, in the professional world, everybody wants to be a leader. Everybody thinks the leader is the most important person in an organization. But a leader is nothing if there are no followers, right? And in a ballroom dance partnership where there are two people, one is a leader and one is a follower, and that couple must dance as one unit. You can never win a competition if each person is, if they're not dancing together, okay? And it's very visible when a couple, a leader and a follower, are not fully executing their role. Now, it was very difficult for me as a female CEO in my personal or in my professional life to then be a follower on the dance floor. And in fact, that was a constant struggle with my teachers. They would say, will you let me lead? And I would say, oh, right, you're the leader. Okay, you can lead. You know, because once I knew my routine, I was going to dance it. I wasn't even waiting for their lead. I was just dancing my routine. But that's not dancing if you're dancing independent of your partner. So close partnering is critical, as I said, to winning ballroom competitions. And a couple must be able to dance quickly and wordlessly as one unit and seamlessly execute mid-course corrections, you know, to avoid collisions on the dance floor. And one of my business partners very astutely said to me, you know, if you hadn't taken up ballroom dancing, you could never have considered the possibility of selling our agency to someone else and not being the CEO. And he was so right, because I saw on the dance floor that leader and follower were equally important, and you needed to have strength in, you know, they have to be like 100% great at being a leader, and the other person has to be 100% great being the follower. And that's the only hope that they have for winning. And so I felt that if I sold the agency and someone else was a CEO, I could be a strong partner and collaborator and follower. And in fact, being a strong follower wasn't necessarily a bad thing. And in fact, it could be a winning strategy. And in fact, that's how I built my business from a small startup PR agency with 13 employee owners to my last agency, which is one of the top 10 largest independent PR firms in the country with 6 offices and 240 employee owners. Now, the way I did this was selling my agency to create, you know, a bigger mid-sized agency and in close partnering with someone else who is like-minded. And so that's how we sold PT & Company, my first agency, to a Richmond, Virginia-based PR agency to create CRT Tanaka. We did that for 8 years. And then we sold CRT Tanaka to a Minneapolis-based PR agency to create Padilla CRT. So I look at it as, I built my business by close partnering with others to form successively larger mid-sized national agencies that were all award-winning PR firms.
In Patrice Tanaka's book, she talks a lot about being a perfectionist.
I was a perfectionist. And one of my former partners said to me at one time, perfectionism is overrated. And he's so right. What I learned from professional dancers is they don't think about perfection as, you know, a destination they'll ever achieve. So they don't even look at it as a destination. They think about perfection as a direction. You're always moving in that direction, but it's not a destination. So if you take it being a destination off the table, it's a lot healthier way to think about continual improvement every day so that you were better than yesterday. And I think that the same approach is what I tried to take to business as well, because I was a perfectionist at work. And in fact, I'm ashamed to say this, but the same colleague who came up with all these pithy observations said, once dubbed me Ayatollah Tanaka, because I was just ruthless about, you know, errors, from typos to sloppy thinking to sloppy execution. I was just ruthless. And, you know, I still don't like sloppy work. But at the same time, you know, I know that the process of trying to do more perfect work is not perfect and error-free. And in fact, if you try to make that process perfect and error-free, it actually crimps creativity and risk-taking, all the things that you need to come up with innovative ideas. So, you know, I'm not a fan of perfectionism. I'm a fan of continual improvement and trying to keep things flowing and things comfortable so people can, you know, come up with their best thinking and in an environment where they feel safe and where they're not going to be ridiculed for, you know, a half-baked idea. Because in that half-baked idea could be the germ of a really great idea. But if you terrorize people to not speaking until they have a fully baked idea, I think you're missing out on a lot of really great thinking.
Patrice Tanaka talks about joy and creating a joyful planet, and I wondered how she felt about conflictual issues.
During this time of pandemic and crises, the way that I've stayed sane and centered, even till this day, is just focusing on living my purpose, right? Choosing joy at every opportunity, being mindful of the joy I have, and sharing that joy with others. And so, yes, there is a lot of vitriol. There is, you know, the reckoning that we are living through of systemic racism. I guess my vision and the work that I do is one and the same. It's called Joyful Planet. That's my vision of the planet. And my vision of the planet is one that is, you know, hallmarked by diversity, equity, and inclusion. And the work that I do with individuals and organizations is to help them gain clarity about the impact they want to make in the world. And in fact, I was working with, you know, this is like the most exciting thing for me, when I can help someone really gain clarity about what is most important for them to accomplish in life. And this is what one person said. I wrote it down because I wanted to be able to share it with you. My purpose in life is to build on the conversation of equity, inclusion, and belonging to help create systemic change and the opportunity for everyone, especially diverse people, to achieve our biggest goals and dreams. Now, that's pretty exciting, and she was pretty excited about her life purpose statement. And we talked about ways that she could actually begin to live her purpose more fully, and she's embarked on that. And so this is the way that I helped to make an impact and to create the world that I want, and a world that is one where people are leveraging their talents, their expertise, and their passion in service of other people and our planet. And that's not tied to any specific, you know, red or blue state or Democrat or Republican party. I think people are people. If we are there to be of service to one another and to help, you know, make a positive impact on the planet, that's a good thing. It's a good place for me, for everyone.
I wondered specifically how the COVID-19 pandemic was affecting Patrice Tanaka and her professional world, her ballroom dance.
Oh my God, it's been terrible for ballroom dancing, because all the studios have closed. All these ballroom professionals have been unable to conduct lessons. Some of them have been able to do virtual lessons, but it's less than, you know, optimal to be doing a virtual Zoom lesson and trying to do the waltz with your teacher. But for me personally, as I said, you know, I've just focused on living my purpose. And actually, during this time of COVID and other crises, I've done things that I didn't think I would be doing prior to the pandemic. And in fact, one of the things I did to prove to myself and other people that there could be joy in a time of coronavirus, I actually organized a Zoom event series called Joy in a Time of Coronavirus. And every 2 weeks, I featured either an artist or a healer, someone who could offer comfort and joy to the people that I invited to be part of the hour that we spent together. It was just a way to create a sense of community online and give people something that would help them to get through this challenging time. So that's one of the things I did. And then I did another thing in May. I co-organized the first ever Asian American and Pacific Islander Heritage Month celebration for the PR Museum. They were doing celebrations for all other ethnic groups, and I asked the founder, why haven't you done one for Asian Americans? And she said, will you help me organize it? So of course, I said, okay, if we're gonna, let's do it, because we need to do one, because Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders deserve representation too, you know. So we organized this great event. It was 16 Asian American and Pacific Islander leaders in communications, media, PR, digital, and entertainment during May, which is Asian American and Pacific Islander Heritage Month. So that wasn't something I had planned to do, but it was definitely a joyful choice. Not every moment in the organizing of it, but overall, it was total joy. And then I also agreed in April, I think it was, to co-chair something called the Diversity Action Alliance. 15 of the largest PR industry organizations got together in a coalition, and they actually got together last year, but things started really heating up. And this coalition is focused on improving diversity, equity, and inclusion in the PR profession. And so they asked me to co-chair this, not something that I was really focused on, but at the same time, in the aftermath of George Floyd, we all felt the urgency and the need to do something. So I've been involved in doing this. And we actually have, one of the exciting things is there has been no diversity data for the PR industry. The industry has talked about this for decades, and I've been hearing and being part of these conversations, but no one wanted to submit their diversity data so we could even, have a baseline reading of what it was. It wasn't going to be pretty, but at least we needed a baseline reading so we could track improvement year over year. Well, this coalition has gotten commitments from 300 organizations and individuals, including 18 of the top 25 largest PR firms. And we are going to be releasing our first diversity data for the PR profession in January 2021. And so we'll be able to track our success in improving diversity, equity, and inclusion. So those are just a few of the things I'd never thought I would be doing pre-COVID. But again, it was part of my choosing joy and sharing my joy with others. So, and that is the litmus test for me deciding what I'm going to do or what I'm not going to do. So, and doing this is part of my joy, because it was such a joy meeting Sue, and I think she mentioned this, when I was in North Dakota, I think it was in December 2018, I went there to conduct my Discover Your Life and Leadership Purpose workshop for two Vistage International groups that were being led by John Jennings, a really great guy. And Sue was my Uber driver going from the hotel to the airport. And we just had, it was a short ride, but we spoke about so much. I found out she was an author and all these wonderful things that she's done, including adopting children from Africa and how the big family that she has. I just loved meeting her. And so I was delighted when she reached out to me and asked me if I wanted to be part of this program. So anyway, it was just joy, kind of compounded.
Now, if you read Patrice Tanaka's book, Becoming Ginger Rogers, she is professionally through it all, head of a public relations agency. We hear a lot about how that works. It's kind of fun. But it's been a few years since the book was published and some things have changed. She is now the chief joy officer for Joyful Planet. So I asked her to talk about what's been happening.
Yeah. Well, you know, I was in the PR industry for 35 plus years, and I loved my career. And I, you know, was very successful at it and built three award-winning PR and marketing agencies. But I just had the feeling that I wanted to do something else. I wasn't quite sure what. And then as I was thinking about leaving the agency after my earnout in August 2015, I was thinking about my life and career, and I realized that the two biggest decisions that I made for myself and for my businesses were, one, when I articulated a business purpose for my first agency to create great work, a great workplace, and great communities at work, and how powerful that simple articulation of business purpose was in helping us achieve what we did. And then when I was forced by my executive coach to discover and articulate my own life purpose, and how much has happened in the past 18 years since I, you know, shared with her that my purpose in life was simply to choose joy, to be mindful of that joy, and to share that joy with others. And my life really just took off, from the ballroom dancing to competing to writing the book to co-founding two other PR agencies, and then deciding to start Joyful Planet, which is focused on helping individuals and organizations discover and actively live or operationalize their purpose. And then I wrote two other best-selling books on life purpose and organizational purpose. And I'm doing a lot with the nonprofits that I'm involved with, because they're all being very severely impacted by COVID, right? So we've had a lot of brainstorming work about how we can continue to deliver our mission even during a time of COVID, and could we deliver our mission so that once COVID has passed, we could be in a stronger position for the future. So there's a lot of that work. And then all this diversity DEI work that I've been doing unexpectedly. So much has happened.
Now, remember that what you're listening to is from a recording of a webinar that was done about this book, and it's part of a whole series, One Book, One North Dakota. You can go to the humanitiesnd.org website and look up information about upcoming books and discussions in the series. They do one a month. Well, at this point, we started to take questions from webinar participants, and a woman named Laura Berry asked, how did Patrice Tanaka, with all going on in her life, find time to write a book?
Yeah, well, I wanted to write the book by myself. And my agent said, oh, so you're going to take 10 years to write the book? I said, what? She said, well, you have more than a full-time job with your agency. If you really are serious about writing this book and getting it out, you know, sooner rather than later, then I suggest that I partner you with a writer who can help you write the book. You can write part of it, but let her do the heavy lifting of, you know, figuring out the arc of every chapter and the overall arc of the book, and then writing certain sections and letting you write certain sections that only you can write. So it's like, okay. So she set me up. Yeah, I still wasn't convinced, but then she set me up with some interviews with writers, and I said, aren't you going to be on the call with me? And she said, no, when you find somebody that you think you'll be able to collaborate with, you'll know who that is. And I did. As soon as I met a wonderful woman who has co-authored a lot of books with other people, her name is Lynette Padua, and she was joy to work with. And in fact, she told me when we were talking that I want to make this process of writing the book as joyful for you as I possibly can make it. So it was still a lot of work, because I wrote half of the book, she wrote half of the book, and then she stitched it together. And then I had to go through the whole book a number of times and edit it, because she wasn't a ballroom dancer, and she didn't work in the PR field. So she didn't really have an understanding of both. And sometimes she'd write it in a way, and I'd edit it back. She'd edit it back, and I'd say, Lynette, this is how we talk in the ballroom world or in the PR world. It has to be this way. So anyway, it was a great negotiation. And when I read the book, I can't even remember which sections I wrote and which sections she wrote, because for her to write the book, she actually interviewed me extensively and everything was recorded and transcribed. And so she actually used my words in writing her section. So when I'm reading it, it sounds like what I said, but she just stitched it together so that it worked really well. So I could not have finished this book without Lynette. And in fact, you know, my agent was shopping the book at a time. She thought she would get an easy yes from a publisher. But in fact, this happened in 2008, and the publishing industry, everything changed, and she was having a hard time finding someone who would be interested. She finally found a publisher who himself was a swing dancer and thought this was a great idea. Yeah. That helped.
Webinar participant Sue Duffy had a question about presentation, how we present ourselves, and Patrice Tanaka's take on how important that is. Sue said she was thinking about it because in the experience of people working from home, working in their pajamas, does a low presentation affect expectations of results?
Yes, again, this is something I learned in the ballroom world. It's not just enough to be dressed to the nines on the dance floor when you're competing. It's everything you say and do and the way that you present yourself from the moment you arrive at the airport to catch your flight to go to the city where the competition is being held. Because on your plane might be some judges who, if they see you looking sloppy and disheveled and speaking inappropriately, are going to remember that when they see you on the dance floor. You know, presentation is like, I can't remember if it's a fifth or fourth of the score. So it's not insignificant. It's enough so that if you don't mark well in that section, you could lose. So every single aspect of, you know, competition is important, and I carry that, you know, extend that into my personal and professional life as well. You know, I don't want to, it'll be too long, but I try to make an effort.
There was something I had to ask Patrice Tanaka about, and that is her great affection and support for the Girl Scouts. The Girl Scouts, it seemed a little anomalous to me. The suave, sophisticated, fancy world of ballroom dancing and the tough, hard-charging world of being a top PR executive. How exactly did that match up with the Girl Scouts? And I like the Girl Scouts. My family's been involved with them. But I was curious about Patrice Tanaka's special place for them in her life.
You know, I was a Girl Scout since I was 5 years old in Hawaii. And really, being a Girl Scout is my longest affiliation in life. I've been a Girl Scout for more than 60 years. I mean, it's shocking to me. I've been on the board of the Girl Scouts of Greater New York for the past 24 years. And I have, my agency represented Girl Scouts of the USA, the national organization. So I'm, and also, and I don't think I'm alone in realizing that our greatest challenge as women is that we need to create gender equity, more gender balanced leadership. We need more women leaders sitting at every leadership table. And because Girl Scouts is the largest girl serving organization dedicated to leadership development, I view Girl Scouting as our biggest pipeline for our next generation leaders. So if anything, I feel that Girl Scouting is more relevant today than ever before, even when I was growing up and happy to be a Brownie in Troop 45 in Kaneohe, Hawaii. So I am, yes, a very vocal advocate of girl leadership, girl empowerment, and more women leaders.
We are listening to selections from a webinar that was done by Grace Tanaka, sponsored by Humanities North Dakota and the Paris Family Foundation. Grace Tanaka wrote Becoming Ginger Rogers and talks about her life and her experiences. And the next question that came in the webinar was very personal, very specific. And I'm just going to play myself reading the question as it came in. Here's a question from Jim. What do you recommend for finding one's life purpose for a person who is 51 with master's degree in management and about to be an empty nester, but whose main focus in life has always just been to put food on the table and pay the bills, but never really feeling life fulfillment at work? I still have to pay the bills. Love your story. Thank you for sharing. So,
thank you. That's a great question, because I tell people, based on the work that I've been doing in this area since for the past 5 years, is that what I found is people are more willing to think about their life purpose in their 50s. And for, you know, and it's kind of understandable, because in your 50s, you've probably, and sometimes it's on the heels of a major life event, right? Loss of a job, loss of a career, divorce, death of a spouse, children leaving the nest. You have a little bit more time to think about your life and evaluate whether, you know, it is fulfilling and joyful to you. And so I get a lot of people who want to work with me because they're ready now to kind of spend time to think about their life purpose. And so 50 is a great time to do this. And I actually have, I work one-on-one with people. So if you're interested, you can just go to my website and it'll, you know, there's information there. But I love helping people to get clarity about their life purpose, because if you're in your 50s, you could conceivably live and, you know, be productive for the next 30 or 40 years. That's a lot of life to, you know, to be able to maybe finally do something that is going to feed your soul more than you've done before. I also tell people, because this is the thing, a lot of people are afraid to discover their life purpose because they think they're going to have to quit their day job in order to, you know, live their life purpose fully. And that is not true, because your life purpose isn't tied to your job or your career. A life purpose overarches your entire life. And the thing is, if you don't know your life purpose, you can't fully live your life purpose in any area of your life, in your personal or your professional life. It's only when you have clarity about your life purpose can you more fully live your purpose at work and, you know, outside of work. And in fact, I don't know if we're going to talk about this, but this reminds me of one of the most enlightened CEOs in corporate America. Satya Nadella talks about this. Microsoft has a business purpose to empower individuals and organizations to do more. So that's their business purpose. But beyond that, he wants every Microsoft employee to be able to live their life purpose through the vehicle of Microsoft, so they can say, I don't work for Microsoft. Microsoft works for me. Now, that is brilliant, because it goes beyond just being a purpose-driven organization. It's trying to create a purpose-driven organization fueled by purpose-driven employees. And that's the next level up to, you know, even higher productivity and profitability. But for individuals who are looking to discover their life purpose, one of the things that I like to tell people, and this sounds a little crass, but discovering and actively living your life purpose is a competitive advantage. in your personal and professional life. Because when I look at the things that I've done that I had no idea I would do in the past 18 years since I discovered and began to actively live my purpose, I've done many more things than I did in the previous, 18 years of my life. And I don't think I was a slouch in those years. It's just that the things that I've accomplished in the past 18 years are very specific and personal to me being able to be fulfilled in living my purpose and serving others and making a positive impact on the planet. So I urge you to put some time now and to think about your purpose.
So as you've heard, Patrice Tanaka has been working with her organization that she's head of called Joyful Planet. And she was asked if there's any experience group or people she worked with that really stood out to her.
I've had the opportunity to work with so many amazing for-profit and not-for-profit organizations. And I guess one that stands out was for Dress for Success Worldwide. I'm a huge fan of that nonprofit. And I actually know Joy Gordon, who started, she didn't start the organization, it was started before her, but when she took over 20 something years ago, it was in the basement of a church in Manhattan. Now that organization is global and they're in 40 countries and 100 sites, maybe more than 100 sites. Anyway, she asked me to come and work with 100 delegates that they were inviting. These are clients of Dress for Success who first came to the organization for help, right? And they're involved in a professional development program that the sites have. So she asked me if I would work with them. So I decided, and this was over a 3-day, 2-night period, they were actually on a cruise that Carnival Cruise Lines had gifted them. So 100 delegates from around the world, they were coming on this cruise, and there were a number of speakers and trainers like me, and I decided I was going to work with every single one of them prior to them getting onto the cruise so that they could share their life purpose with the rest of the delegates and then be affirmed by the response from the rest of their fellow delegates. And so they could have great clarity when they went back to their individual communities and developed and executed their community action plan, which all of these delegates were required to do as part of this opportunity. So they were going back into their community to help other women and to help them to become, you know, economically independent. So working and helping 100 people prior to the cruise so that when they got on the cruise, and then I had them get up one by one and share their life purpose statement. And it was very, very moving. And people cried. And it was just, it was, you know, one of the highlights of the recent couple of years. I think I did this last May, and it was just wonderful. But there are many, many, many things like that. In fact, the two Vistage Worldwide workshops that I did in North Dakota, in Bismarck, North Dakota, were probably my favorite Vistage workshops they did. The people that were in each group were so warm and wonderful. And John Jennings, who's been the CEO of companies in North Dakota and who's leading both of these Vistage groups. One group is full of CEOs of companies, and the other one is employees, kind of next level down leaders in companies. And it's kind of a peer-to-peer coaching program. So I came in to help each of them discover and articulate their life purpose. So I love doing that. And I love the opportunity to visit North Dakota, which I had never visited. And that's, and I think I've visited every state except for 4 states. I've even been to South Dakota because at one time we represented Gateway Computers. So I've got the Dakotas covered.
Throughout Grace Tanaka's book, Becoming Ginger Rogers, she has sections. She calls each one an intermezzo, and they each one describes a different dance that is part of the approved dances for ballroom dancing competition. And for each dance, she gives us a fairly detailed and fairly insidery technical description of how the dance is performed and how people work on it and practice it. And then also her feeling about the essence, the spirit of the dance that comes through so much. Well, one of the participants in the webinar, Sue Duffy, commented about these pieces. And as you'll hear, that leads into another reading.
She says, Sue says, I enjoyed the parts where you described the steps and the rhythmic moves of the different dances. I'm a big fan of Dancing with the Stars, and now I have the pages flagged according to the dance so that the next time I watch, I will be a much more educated watcher. So that leads perfectly into you reading your next section.
Thank you, Sue. That was a great lead-in. So let me put my readers on so I can see. So I wrote these intermezzo pieces, I call them, on each dance between some of the chapters. And the last section, the coda, is about the cha-cha. When you dance, really dance, your feet are not just stepping through the patterns. They connect you to the earth. And from the earth, your dancing feet draw living vitality and power that radiates upward, flowing like an electric current between you and your partner at your joined hands, your gently touching arms, and your attentive gaze. That's connection. The flirty cha-cha is a perfect conduit for it, practically announcing with a wink, here I come, baby. The cha-cha moves you in and out of your partner's space. When he breaks back, she breaks forward into the space he was in. When she breaks back, he breaks forward into the space she was in. The lively but moderate tango of the cha-cha makes it feel playful to trade spaces this way, whereas the slower rumba feels sultry and their faster mambo feels intense. In the basic cha-cha pattern, other than breaks, the partners move simultaneously in a triple step. It's this section that can help you develop real feeling for the contact of your feet with the earth. There's a simplicity to cha-cha movement that allows you to focus on essentials. You don't have to project your body through long strides as you would in a smooth dance like the waltz. You don't have to worry about generating as much Cuban motion in the hips as you would in the rumba or the kind of bounce you need in the samba. And you don't have to move your feet as quickly as you would in the mambo. You can relax into the game of moving together and using the floor as your ally. The distinctive triple step of the cha-cha came about because slower versions of Cuban mambo music left dancers with extra time between forward and back breaks. Simply holding in place would have been too static. They filled the extra time with a triple step called a chassé, a quick staccato combination in which you step with one foot and your other foot seems to chase it on to its next step. People called this dance triple mambo for a time. Legend has it that the distinctive sound of women's shoes sliding across the floor, using it to generate the chassé, gave the now new dance its name. 2-3-cha-cha-cha. 2-3-cha-cha-cha. The cha-cha was easier than the mambo for eager dancers to master, yet frisky enough to make a gal feel like a hot number and a guy feel like a cool cat. American pop culture of the 1950s and early 60s embraced the cha-cha as fervently as a first love. But rock and roll broke up America's affair with the cha-cha by offering something wilder and more rebellious. A different kind of earthiness took over social dancing as partners let go of each other almost completely, kicked off their shoes, and tried to connect with each other as individuals, moving to their unique beats, above and beyond patterns, outside conventional partnerships. For many years, ballroom and Latin dances became the province of aficionados, competitors, and professional dancers. Generations grew up without experiencing the profound pleasure of taking the hand of an acquaintance or loved one and moving together to the music. Many would say, "I wish I had learned it. I wish I could." They would watch in wonder as glamorous professional dancers on television took non-dancing stars of all ages in hand and taught them how to control their feet and thus their bodies. Mastering the routines set many of the novice dancers free of insecurities, free of excess weight, free of the constrictions of their jobs and images. Dances like the cha-cha or the samba or the elegant waltz can relight a vital spark in anyone. You'll feel connected to the music, to the earth beneath your feet, and to your partner. Most important, you'll connect with the deepest part of yourself. When that happens, you may never want to stop dancing. Why should you? Let joy be unconfined.
Patrice Tanaka. That's from the webinar that she did as part of the One Book, One North Dakota series, put on by Humanities North Dakota with support from the Paris Family Foundation. It is part of a series, and you can find out more about the whole thing if you go to humanitiesnd.org and look for One Book, One North Dakota. You go to their upcoming events and classes, and you will see several of them listed because there are several still to come, and you can sign up to participate live in the webinars. Some that have already happened, Leif Enger talking about his book Virgil Wander, Chuck Klosterman talking about his recent published book of essays Raised in Captivity, and Larry Watson talking about the lives of Edie Pritchard. Larry Watson, of course, has just had one of his novels turned into a major motion picture, Let Him Go, with Kevin Costner and Diane Lane. Now, you just heard Patrice Tanaka, and she and the others I just mentioned will be posted for listening, edited versions, on Prairie Public's website, prairiepublic.org. But still to come in the One Book, One North Dakota series, Hyde Erdrich will talk about her book, Little Big Bully. Terry Shoptaw will talk about his book, Sons of the Wild Jackass. It's about the Nonpartisan League. It's a nonfiction book. Susan Power will talk about her classic Native American novel, The Grass Dancer. And Deb Marquardt from German-Russian country in North Dakota, she will talk about her book, The Horizontal World. And The Horizontal World refers to the world such as it is in a place like North Dakota. Brenda K. Marshall talks about Dakota, or What's a Heaven For? Sierra Crane Murdoch will talk about her book, which made quite a splash this year, Yellow Bird. And then Tom Eason, who should be familiar to listeners of Prairie Public, will talk about his book of essays all about the prairies and the plains, Pacing Dakota.